Welcome to the Evercore ISI 2020 webinar with Sharif Fota of National Energy Services Reunited. Speaking today from Evercore ISI will be energy analyst James West. I'd like to remind everyone that the material in this webinar is based upon information considered to be reliable, but neither Evercore ISI nor its affiliates guarantee its completeness or accuracy. Assumptions, opinion, and recommendations contained herein are subject to change without notice. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. This material is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security, and we will not be disclosing any non-public information. Our speaker will be taking questions via the questions window on the webinar control panel. Please type in your questions at any time during the presentation. And now I'll turn the microphone over to James West.
Thanks, Emily, and good afternoon to everyone. Sorry again for the technical difficulties we experienced this morning, but we're glad to once again get started, and hopefully this will go much better. Thank you for joining us. This is our second webinar where we're bringing you one-on-one access with key industry thought leaders in the energy and particularly the oilfield services space. And today we have a very special guest who is the CEO of a company that we initiated back in the third quarter of 2018, known as National Energy Services Reunited, or NESR for short. NESR is primarily the brainchild of Sharif Fota, formerly the head of Schlumberger's Production Group, a division where he oversaw $20 billion in annual revenues and 30,000 employees. Following a $230 million IPO in May of 2017 as a SPAC, NESR is now a leading regional oilfield service operator in the Middle East and North Africa after purchasing two first-class energy services businesses in MENA, while the company's also been growing its presence in Asia Pacific. Seeking opportunities to take advantage of a steady but fragmented market in the Middle East, by November 2017, NESR had purchased Natural Petroleum Services and Gulf Energy, two leading regional oilfield service companies that offer products and services spanning drilling, completion, production, and related equipment. Since then, we've seen Sharif have been an exceptionally busy 2 years. In the past 12 months alone, he's kept the company focused on pursuing partnerships, such as the one with NexTier Oilfield Solutions, acquiring companies such as Egypt and Cipco, and also signing over $1 billion worth of deals with national oil companies such as Saudi Aramco and Kuwait Oil. Before I turn it over to Sharif, I wanted to provide some quick facts on NESR, other than the fact that it remains one of our few outperform rated stocks after we downgraded the sector recently. Number one, the company operates in 15 countries with a very strong presence in Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, Algeria, the UAE, and Iraq. Number two, strategically, the company has been very busy, both expanding its core contracts in Saudi with deals spanning more than 5 years, making inroads in new countries like Bahrain and Kuwait, refinancing its credit facilities on favorable terms, and most recently performed a large-scale, significant unconventional gas stimulation services contract in Saudi. And lastly, as we all know, this region is seeing increased spending on exploration and production, the U.S. alone having half the world's oil proven reserves and accounts for about one-third of global production. So this is going to be a very busy, very interesting area to watch, and of course, with the recent moves with OPEC Plus, certainly very glad to have Sharif on today. So with that, Sharif, let me hand it over to you for any opening comments.
Thank you, James. Thanks for the kind and very generous introduction. And indeed, we are, we are in unprecedented time, I would say, in the current environment worldwide. And despite having an opposite problem to the oil field industry now by a sharp increase of our activity, in the last couple of weeks, we remain vigilant and very close to our customer and employees. And in the current, again, in the environment, the safety and the well-being of all our people are the utmost, the most important thing for us today. We want to make sure that we are very close to our customer. We are their trusted partner to cope up with the growth, the massive growth we have in some countries, and ensuring that we have the people available to execute on these projects, with all the travel ban and the restriction and the border closing in a lot of the countries. So again, obviously it's a good problem to have in the current environment, but very, very important to be very, very close to our customer and people, and definitely in a very tough time.
Maybe I could just start with your supply chain. Clearly, you just talked a bit about what you're seeing in terms of employees. So what about the supply chain? Have you seen disruptions at this point? Are you expecting to see disruptions? How does your inventory situation look, and kind of how is that situation playing out?
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had planned from day one when we launched our what we call the CMT and the business continuity team and obviously the emergency response team, etc. And this is to take into effect a lot of issues. So the number one is the well-being of the people, ensuring that they go and having the continuity, talking to their families, etc. So that's from the safety precaution on the people. And part of that business continuity is definitely the supply chain. So opposite, again, to what we've been doing of optimizing and ensuring the working capital and the inventory is minimized, to be honest, we obviously immediately, and that's the beauty of being agile, is to look into the exact opposite. How can I make sure that I have 6 to 9 months supply in the critical countries? And now I know as well that some of them will have a sharp increase of activity. Can we make sure that we ship the products and spare parts to those countries, because knowing that they will have a problem later on? So we did this from the beginning in early February. We spoke to a lot of our very close partners and suppliers to ensure that they send some of this ahead of time. Some of them, again, very agile like us, and we managed to do that. I give you an example, for example, the perforation and the charges. And we know that how is this explosive is an issue in a lot of countries, and it will definitely, when the border closed down and the security, will be an issue. So we made sure that, for example, we send the supply for 6 months in advance. So today I have supply in 6 months in advance in those countries to ensure that I can cope with the growth and manage the customer needs. So it works. It's a work in process. Definitely there are pockets where the supplies are extremely disturbed. And what we did is we looked immediately at alternatives. And some of the alternatives, for example, does not come from China, and some of these products, and we discuss with the client and discuss with the supplier to ensure that we can send this, and definitely working on the cash position and working with the customer, we looked at most of this stuff is on consignment. So we send a lot of spares and a lot of products ahead of time for a longer period of time, but we need to make sure as well we maintain the cash position. So a lot of it is done with a win-win situation on a consignment basis.
Okay, good. That's good to hear, Sharif. And maybe could you, given your presence in the region and some of the events that happened with the OPEC Plus agreement falling apart, could you talk a little bit about what you're seeing, particularly in Saudi, in terms of them ramping up or potentially ramping up activity and production?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the comment today on what happened, I think it's clear for most of the people. So the main issue, what do you see on the floor, on the ground, is the GCC is definitely are not minimizing or cutting any of the activity. On the opposite, it's you see an increase of activity, and I think the most is definitely Saudi Arabia. And I mean, it goes without saying, I mean, most people that follow, they heard the conference call, their earning call. Today they are a public company, so they make earning call, and they are very clear, they were very assertive in saying, I am producing 12.3 million barrels per day in April. And following that, they will determine what they should see they need to do for May. So but for April, they will produce 12 million barrels, and which means that their activity increase. And the activity is not because they have to produce 12, no, it's just because they have the capability of doing that by opening a tab, basically. But what happens is there is a lot of activity on the rig list, on sites where usually we would have expected some of it to slow down and move to gas. And what we are seeing today, no, it's both are running full speed. So you have the gas full on and you have the oil full on. And that's why we maintain a capacity and ensuring that we can take that growth, because not all the companies in the kingdom are managing to cope with that growth because they have an issue with labor. So today, the main problem of meeting some of those activity in the region in general will be the restriction on people movement and products. So whoever is not ready or did not plan for this ahead of time will have an issue.
And have you seen evidence that your in-country competitors did not plan ahead, did not move people into the country in supplies?
Yes. So some did not, and either because they depend on a majority of what I call rotators, they do not have enough national people in the country. So obviously, if you were planning, if you did not plan ahead, then you had a lot of 80% of your population are rotating people, and they are not in the country, they are restricted, right? And some others had an issue with they did not plan because of maybe cash position, etc., on some of the extra supplies. So I'm not saying it's across the board, definitely not. You have a lot of, obviously, the very established, strong service company that had very good plans in place, similar to us, and some others did not. So we definitely take this as an opportunity to keep the growth and taking a part of the people that are not ready. And we're already doing that. So we replaced already two competitors over the last week that could not manage to have people on site.
Understood. And then maybe if we just stick to society for a minute, the venture with Next Tier and the movement of one of their spreads into the country, I know there's a process that you've been going through to ramp up and prove your capabilities. Could you, one, talk about how you guys were able to confirm that award in the first place, and then how that project is going?
Yeah, so the project is definitely very successful. We are working, when we send the crew and we send the fleet and we send the setup, just to elaborate more, this setup is not like the United States setup of one Permian crew. This is like a mini city. So you have testing, right, milling, plugs, camps. So it's like 130, 140 people on site. And we have the crew, the main key parts of the crew are the people experienced in the Permian doing 4,000 or 5,000 stages earlier, a very professional team, and those are around 12, 13 people. What we did is we wanted to ensure the continuity of that performance, which we are doing today, which we are the best performing fleet in the Middle East. How can we ensure that this continue and had no disruption? So definitely we looked at all our national team that are very strong and very motivated to operate, and they are Saudi, so they live in Saudi. And then we looked at the crew that are on rotation from Next Tier, and we had a very close discussion, even Robert and myself, with the team, and ensured that they, first of all, we send the crew that just before the closing the border between the U.S. and Saudi. So this is a fresh crew, and we agreed with them that they are have no problem to operate there for 3 to 4 months. If the border or if the flights are not back on. So, and that's how you ensure that first you have a backup, but you have a fresh crew that are willing and happy to operate for that period of time. And you work on making sure that they are relaxed during that period by just sitting, going back to the town and some others taking care of their jobs. But meanwhile, we are preparing a crew once the border opens, then they will be able to start going there and operating. So today, our fleet, I was just talking to the team this morning, they managed to do 8 stages. So its performance is absolutely impeccable. And the key is they continue to do that and to be the trusted partner for Aramco, because definitely the Jafurah is one of their top priority, and they are planning to have exactly what they announced, which is a full-on fleet with pads back-to-back until end of 2021.
That's very impressive. Could you just remind our group the average number of stages per day for a frac spread in the Middle East?
I mean, it depends where you are, obviously. So, I mean, some of the listener now, they would be shocked that sometimes you do a stage a week. So it depends where you are. It depends the setup. Is it conventional or unconventional? Some of it requires testing between every stage. So the technicality of the jobs are completely different. But when you want to compare apple to apple, that's where the Jafurah was unique, because that's how Aramco did an amazing job of planning this and appraising the reservoir ahead of time for 5 years, and making sure that they had the exploration wells and understanding exactly what needs to be done from supply chain. So when they go to the factory mode, like the U.S., they are ready. But that, taking that, obviously, what we did is we almost double or tripled the stage per day that used to be done in the last 3 to 4 years. So, and that's why working together with them, we kind of prove the fact that even with the supply chain and the industry that is different in Saudi, obviously, than the U.S., we are managing together to do the same performance like the U.S.
Very impressive. Maybe if we just step outside of Saudi for a minute here, you've been ramping in two countries recently, Bahrain and Kuwait. Could you describe both your success in those two countries and kind of what you're seeing now post the breaking of the agreement?
So sure. Bahrain is definitely you know about the discovery. His Excellency and announced it, and the Minister of Bahrain, and we've been working very close to them. So we won a couple of contracts. We set up properly. We have a very experienced Bahraini country director running the show, and we're doing very, very good. Now the scale will yet to be seen, right? Because obviously it's an exploration phase. The number of wells, etc., will be determined towards the coming month. Obviously, with what's happening, there is some slowdown of the program, because again, it's an initial stage. If I move to Kuwait, and very, very proud of what we have done there. Because we hit the floor running, or we hit the ground running, is we managed to get a very big contract in cementing, and we are performing exactly as the big guy, not or even better, that's been there for years and years and years. So you know, we took that contract from one. And we have been steadily performing and taking the rigs 5, 10, 15. So today we supply exactly what we want to supply. We can take more. We told the customer we are capable. They see that we are capable. They are very happy. We are scoring the top 3 provider every month on service quality, so which gives us that strength. On the other hand, we got a couple of drilling contracts, and we are working on that as well. On the same time, this is basically the fishing remedial through tubing, jars, TRS type of contract, and we are working on that. So Kuwait is well set up for the current activity we have, yet we are very small. Yeah, people have to understand that we are extremely, extremely small. I mean, this is a market of more than almost $2 billion. So definitely what we want to be there is to get more segments to be able to have some critical mass similar to our very big position in Saudi and in Oman.
So how many segments are you running in Kuwait today?
We have today 3 segments.
Okay, and the idea would be to get all your segments in.
Oh yeah, obviously this will take time, because you know Kuwait, you have to have an award, you have to have a contract to be able to. So you have to wait for the contract to be tendered, and then once it's tendered, then you need to be qualified, And then obviously you have to win. So
right.
It's going to take time, right? So it's not, I mean, every country in the Middle East is very unique. And that's again, the barrier of entry to newcomers is very high, right? So it's, you know, that's why we like it as well. So.
Got it. And then perhaps we could talk about Oman, which is basically home for you guys. I know that you have a long and rich history there. What are you seeing on the ground today? And is there, do you have the ability to gain more share in Oman, given your already very large position?
Yeah, we're definitely working on the, on that. It's going to be slower than the others. So to think about our position in Oman, you have to think about like the big three. So we have, that's the only country in the Middle East where our market share is significant, very well established. We have 85% Omanis. I think we have the highest Omanization in any company in service industry. We are we have a manufacturing facility. We opened, as you saw on our announcement, we opened casing hardware, the first one in the Middle East. We are working on a drilling hub for the customer. Some of the segment, we have almost 85% market share. Very, very strong, very close relationship with all the, you know, the PDO, Oxy, BP, definitely His Excellency, the Minister and the team. So very well established position. And therefore, we more or less you have your growth is depending on the growth of the country. Some of the segments we are still, couple of the segments we're still weak. So we are looking into that, how can we establish and get more position in that. But we have obviously some of the other segments, I would say there is no, you will only grow when the market grow because we have 80 to 90% market share, right? So we are already very big, right? So very strong position. What we want to do is we want to maintain our social impact in the country. We have a lot of joint project with the ministry, with the customer to ensure the establishment of, you know, real ICV, in-country value and local content. You know, Oman is going to implement a lot of, if you're not Omani, basically, you will not be allowed to bid for almost 60% of the work. So we you have to as well demonstrate your ESG and on all aspects of the job, how your diversity, your women in charge, your Omani and the top position. All our managers in Oman are Omanis. The VP of the country is Omani. All his direct reports are Omani. I mean, we very, very solid and very proud of our position. And that's exactly the model we want to have in all the GCC and the Middle East countries.
Okay, that makes sense. And Maybe since you brought it up on the ESG side, you guys were very early when you established the company and hiring a head of ESG and very, very much focused on that. Could you maybe talk, Sharif, a bit about why you thought that was important, you know, at inception? We obviously, as investors, we all know it's growing in importance, particularly now, but why you were there early and is that a critical driver? Obviously, it is in Oman, but in other areas of the Middle East.
Yeah, sure. So, if as you rightly mentioned, James, the whole aspect and the philosophy of even creating that company is based on ESG. So, in the sense of especially on the S part now. So, the whole idea of being a national champion of the Middle East and creating that social impact of recruiting, hiring, being close to the customer, being manufacturing in country, being aligned with the vision of the majority of the GCC is a very crucial part of your S. So actually now, in difficult times, we have to demonstrate our commitment better than any other time. Because you are, if you are today a country, they look at you, are you really my trusted partner? Do I have a security of supply? You being there when everybody is going to run away? Are you really a differentiator when my border is shut down, right? So this is the part of the S that is incredibly important, and we are extremely aligned with the country and the customer and the well-being of our employees, and you have to demonstrate that. And as I keep saying, this is not something because people likes it or because it's a buzzword. No, this is your part of doing good business. If you don't do that, you are not a good citizen. So you have to really do that. Now you look at the other two element of it, is the E and G. And definitely our E, we try to do as much as we can in our capacity. Obviously, we are a service company, we're small. So, but at least let's be proactive. So, for example, we looked at this light tower instead of saving diesel. We presented to Aramco, they loved it, and they made it and they implemented it across the board. We looked at, we are banning all the plastic bottles. We are making sure that our new NORI, which is our new research center, is LEED certified. Full recycling water. We have a huge project today with all the customers in the Middle East to ensure that we can recycle the water, especially if they're going to go to this unconventional and doing 10,000 to 25,000 stage a year. I mean, you're talking about a growth of the unconventional of at least 5x. So how are you going to cope with the water, and what exactly are you doing about it? I mean, even if it's not a problem or it's a slight problem, it's going to be a huge problem. And we need to make this very, very responsibly. And the beauty is our customer look at this as well, very, very focused, right? So I think on the E, that's what we do. And then the governance was the whole idea of putting the company together, right? So the idea, I mean, I had a lot of ideas in the beginning, back in 2017. We said, why don't we make it a private? Why don't we have all our shareholders from the Middle East that want to put this together? But I said, guys, the most important part for us is governance. We need to ensure the company is second to none in terms of compliance, trade. If there is sanction, we do it. So we said that's why we insisted to be in New York. We have the most rigid laws, and that's what we wanted the whole company to be 100% complying with. We wanted to make sure that, you know, all the FCPA, nobody has something better than the other from a shareholder, from the employees. So everybody is equal. So the governed part is very important. And the other part is the philosophy of the compensation. And that is what we looked at ourselves from day one. We need to ensure that this pay disparity that today I personally completely disagree with, that we have, you know, executive paid 500 times more than managers. We need to ensure that this is completely eradicated. We need to ensure that there's absolutely no difference between gender pay, between nationality pay. So we put this all around. Everybody's aligned. So today, our philosophy of compensation is you have everybody on what we call a target that has financial matrix. If you reach what we call a stretch target, you get 200% of your financial part. If you reach an exceptionally high target, which is very ambitious, which is, for example, to give an example, in 2019, we had 30% growth. If you make that, you make the exception. If you don't make it, you don't. But it's every country, the country director have this exposure, have this objective. So to give you an example, two of the country made their exceptional objective. So they got 300%, but corporate did not. So myself, my direct reports did not. And the other part, I made sure that I removed and waived 100% my long-term incentive plan, all my RSUs, for the sake of giving this to all the high value, the top performer employees of the company. And ensuring that they are part of the ownership. And that's why we have like what we call a die-hard organization, right? Everybody works very hard. They believe in it. They own the shares of the company. And the disparity of the pay is nothing. I mean, I have people paid more than my CFO, the country directors, right? So and the difference between myself and others can be even 1.5 times. So, and that's the key, is there is everybody is in that game. And I think from the governance, we should be doing very well. And definitely, as you said, I have a Saudi lady in charge of the ESG of the company. and we put all this in place.
That's great to hear. We obviously, you know, our views on that. So thanks for expanding on that, Sharif. Maybe if we go back to a couple countries, particularly North Africa, you made, I guess one, you know, what's your outlook for Libya, Algeria, and Egypt? And then two, you recently got into Egypt via acquisition. Could you perhaps talk about that a bit?
Sure. If I talk about North Africa, I would say the security situation is going to get really, really rough going forward, in my opinion. I think Libya, with the shutdown, and with nobody needs this oil anyway, I don't think it's going to come back for a while. The beauty we have there is we are 100% Libyan, from the country director to the last person. So everybody's Libyan, everybody's national. So I would say we would be the last man standing before they shut down the operation. So far they did not in the east. But I think depending how far this goes, nobody would need oil, so they might put down the rigs. I would say Algeria will have a problem of, you know, between the virus, between the travel ban, between lack of crews, between obviously the financial constraint on the country. Again, I would say it's going to get slower than what people expected. So my estimate that North Africa is going to contract activity-wise year on year. If I look about Egypt, it will be in the same bucket from an activity point of view. The difference would be that we definitely didn't have any, so it's an add-on for us. Yeah. And the acquisition, as I had mentioned in our quarter, we are very excited about the company. Beside the fact that we enter Egypt, that they have this product line that we do not have, that requires 10 years experience and track record to be qualified to bid. So they are very uniquely positioned on that. They are qualified for all the EPC contractor, and the majority of the work today by the major oil company is done via the EPC, so the Fluor, the Petrojet, the McDormand of the world. And Safesco is qualified and is like even a preferred supplier for some of those companies. So we are looking forward to close. If some delays happens, would be mainly because of the travel. So you have no travel, you have banks closed, you have government not accepting, even now papers. The logistic matter could delay the situation.
Okay, makes sense. Fair enough there. And then Iraq has been out there recently talking about increasing production as well. And they also have security issues on the ground there. Could you talk about your position in Iraq and what you see in the near future?
Yeah. Iraq, we have a bit unique position because we are not in LSTK, correct?
Right.
So for people do not, just to give you a minute explanation of Iraq. So you have Iraq, you have two parts, obviously. You have the Kurdistan and you have Basra. You have the north and you have the south. So the Kurdistan portion of it is characterized by small clients, more independent. And for people to understand on the call, it's more of a US-Canadian type of mood. So when the oil price goes down, most of these guys will not drill, right? Because they make money out of the production. It's not a long, they will not, the most probably they will slow down. So I think the Kurdistan part will definitely slow significantly from their activity. Because of this oil price, there's no point of doing anything. Now you talk to the south, which is the big portion of Iraq, I mean, the majority of the production. And then that's characterized by super major. So that you have Exxon, BP, Eni, etc. You have the Russian, Rosneft, Lukoil, and you have the Chinese, right? So all the drilling is done as LSTK. And why is it LSTK? Because it's a fee per barrel. So the oil company would drill the new wells by having a fixed cost so they can get the cost recovery 100% from BOC, from the Basra oil company, right, from the government. So I think those projects are going to slow down significantly. That's my opinion. right? Because I think the issue with the travel, the ban, the rig readiness, having a lot of de facto Chinese and Russian and you know rigs, I think you're going to have an issue with those LSTK. Plus, if I am an IOC and I have a travel and I have this, why would I start new wells? You know, it's a cost recovery. So what they would focus on is more of the what we call the workover and producing contract, which is basically I keep coil tubing, testing, slick line, perforation, stimulation, so I keep my production because I get a fee per barrel. I get $2 per barrel. What I need is to get to make sure that I get my cash flow from that production. So I think that's what will not be affected, and I think everything else will be significantly affected. So the fortunate fact here for us is we are only into that business because we are not in LSTK, we do not bid LSTK, right? But I think the Iraq will have a security travel, but the most complicated matter for Iraq will be now obviously the proximity with Iran and the border restriction being, you know, either you are with Kuwait or either we are on the other side. So there is a lot of supply delay will happen. So, you know, the region will do not want to slow down, but I think some of those, like North Africa and Iraq, will slow down just due to the logistic and people labor issue.
Understood. Okay. So maybe if we look at the MENA region holistically, I know at one point before the oil price crash, you had talked about growth maybe for the region of 10%, but you thought your growth could be an X, you know, 20%. I mean, how has that changed post oil price crash? What do you now think, or what do you now envision?
So obviously we have several scenario for our forecasting, and again, as we don't give guidance, as you know. So
right.
We look at all this activity. I would say so far we are on plan for our very aggressive target, but we are preparing for that. There is the restriction that's going to happen because of North Africa, because of Iraq, because of what we've been discussing. I believe even when people on the ground, on even the customer, don't see that happening, I think it's going to come. And that's why we prepare for a less growth than our 30-35% year on year. So we look into much less growth than that. I mean, obviously, the good news is we're still growing, but we look at less growth and ensuring that our financial is well taken care of due to that. Because I am positive if this is going to take long, there will be issues with the disruption if you are prepared as a small company like us, but obviously as well with pricing. So if the customer revenue is coming to minus 50-60%, definitely they're going to start coming to all the service company. It's a matter of time. So you have the two pockets of North Africa and Iraq with security and reduction in activity, and you'll have the GCC that wants to go full on with more activity, but definitely they will start to have as well issue with labor and issues with definitely revenue top line and asking for discounts. So that's why we are making sure that we prepare scenarios so we are not surprised.
Understood. Can we actually then delve a little bit further into, I guess, one part, have you seen any pricing pressure yet?
No.
As you think about your balance sheet, you've done some liability management recently with your facilities and optimize the capital structure. Could you talk about what kind of leverage you'd like to have long term?
Okay, so pricing wise, James, no, it's coming, but so far no. So the key is just let's make sure that we hide and stay the last one to be asked. So okay. The second thing is the what you asked about our financial. That's what we do always, what we call the stress test all the time, and we need to make sure that we have obviously a solid balance sheet We need to make sure that, that it remains strong. Our cash position remains strong. We, as you correctly mentioned, we did our refinancing, and that was mainly not because of the, I mean, we obviously got better rate, but we as well, we wanted to take the advantage of now the company is becoming, you know, what they call the national champion of the region, making sure that we have a very coherent and solid banking with a syndicate of big banks together. And we don't, we have only one covenant for our debt, for our, you know, the multiple, EV, EBITDA, et cetera, et cetera. And we did that. We got a better rate. We got better facility. And we wanted to make sure as well, we, if we want to spend more or we want to do more, we can. It's not to take the leverage up, but just to be able to have the capacity and capability to do so. We today like the fact to be 1 and 1.5. That's our leverage ratio. We want to keep it this way. If the situation gets harder, we want to even sometimes when we are depending on the receivable, we pay more debt. So we, if we, if my leverage to be one, yes, why not, right? So that's what we like to have. We will not, what we always say, we do not want to go above two. The key now is to make sure that we as well keep the top line intact and keep our bottom line as healthy as we can. So I would say going forward, we are looking at all this, working with our partners, because one part that is going to come, again, due to logistics, will be the receivable. I mean, today, if you do not even allow, you are not even allowed to, the client office is closed for 6 weeks, you're not submitting invoices for 6 weeks.
Right.
You know? So you, so even if the client and a lot of people, a lot of my country directors tell me, no, we're going to, we know it's a fact. I mean, it's not the first time we live a downturn, right? So it's going to come that the receivable will be delayed. So what you need to do is you need to make sure to manage this. And definitely, again, we talk to all our partners, suppliers, to ensure that we are all in the same boat. So I tell all my my dear partner suppliers, basically, guys, if we are paid in 6 months, we'll pay in 6 months. I mean, it's going to be the same. And today, this is the fact of the matter. So it's not about that I want to hold any payment, but we're going to have to all be in the same boat, and that's the current state of affairs. I mean, the good news is we are working, and the good news, we are growing. So let's just manage the cash position of the company.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Now, Sharif, do you get concerned about equipment in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in North America, which is going to see the, you know, the brunt of the downturn here, that that equipment could somehow migrate into the North Africa and the Middle East over time and cause some oversupply issues?
No. The barrier of entry is extremely difficult. The drive, as I tried to explain in my ESG remarks and the S, is extremely important. This is not the first time a downturn happened. If you look at all the previous ones, same, I mean, obviously, it becomes easier for people to accept the fact that somebody will come. And you saw the Canadian, when they tried, they all lost money and they left. It's not only because you make more, I mean, you make these margins because you understand the region. If you do not understand the region, you actually do not make this margin. You have to know how to manage that. Plus the fact that the client today, what he wants is, I want a very reliable national company, and I want my good citizen international company that has been there for 70, 80 years, properly delivering, properly recruiting, properly training, and that's what I need. I do not want someone to have some, you know, frac pumps or coal tubing units that do not understand anything and bring no value to my country. Because, again, the economy of those countries is based on oil and gas. So it's not only about the profit. It is about employment, keeping the talent, having the manufacturing, and you saw the program. I mean, Activa in Saudi Arabia, ICV in Oman, in ICV in UAE. If you look at what how much you have to spend, you need to do 70% by 2021 to be allowed to come in. Who can come? Who can do that? The current established strong player already having hard time to meet that target, right? So, to be honest, I take this as a very good opportunity because I am today having a very nice discussion with my with our partners in the U.S. to have access to a lot of equipment and to strengthen our position there. But to get somebody new to come in and say, I am going to compete, good luck. Not going to happen.
Right. So you talk about this open platform approach on the technology side. You've got various strategic partnerships. You have an R&D facility, clearly. Could you talk a little bit about how you guys view the research and the innovation of oilfield equipment and services and how this open platform approach is working?
Yeah, so we did the soft inauguration of NORI, our innovation center, and the idea when we presented this to the Mr. Kahtani, the senior VP, and Sagaf, the chairman, the president of the university, was why today if we do not have an issue on IP. So in the sense of I am not creating technology at NEST, right? I am partnering with a lot of people. So I told them, for example, today I'm working on with two big established chemical company to come up with something on frac fluid. So I am open to have my lab for both. And we are open as well for Saudi Aramco and for KFUPM to come and put researcher there. And we are open for those researchers to go back and forth between the Kingdom and the USA establishing those products. We are open that we test in some of the wells that our partner does in the US and some of the wells that Aramco does in Saudi Arabia. So, and that idea, and once we have something, we will be together owning that fluid. And that is so unique because obviously if you are a big company, you cannot do that. It's impossible. I mean, that's your bread and butter, right? You spend ton of money on R&D every year. You cannot open this for anyone, but we can, right? And that is the beauty that we have that other people don't have. And the whole idea that I am going to create the infrastructure because I'm 100% sure, and we already tested that, a lot of the innovator like a VC will not go and establish or pay money or have cost, incur cost in a country in the Middle East. So we created that beautiful infrastructure, which is hopefully we open by the end of the year, where it has state-of-the-art of everything. So it's a beautiful place. We'll have labs, state-of-the-art labs. Again, as I said, LEED certified. So the environment is there. We have the access to the field, the biggest field in the world, which is Saudi Arabia. We have the agreement and the joint agreement between Saudi Aramco and ourselves and the university. So what else do you want? I mean, you have the field, you have the place. So now that's why we are looking into all the innovative people in the US and tell them, guys, you have this amazing innovative technology. It's not proven yet. Some of it is proven, some of it is not proven. If it's not proven, come and you have to put some skin in the game, and your skin in the game is putting a couple of researchers and joint between the lab you have here in the US and the lab now you have in Saudi, and we give you the place, the space, and everything. So that open platform and people getting to new ideas is very well received. Obviously, I can tell you that already the university have other ideas they want to implement and experiment in our facility, and we want to do it jointly together. The other part is the established people. So the established people that don't have a presence ever in the Middle East, we tell them, guys, you need to do something. So example, geodynamics. So today we perforate with that. We told them we have to have a lab that is state of the art in Saudi Arabia. There is only one today is in Brazil. Let's do one there. So once we get the permit, they are going to put the lab there, and we're going to invest and test some of those perforations. Similarly, we are working on some ideas on the drilling, LWD, et cetera. So that is the whole open platform that you are able to deal with the best brain without being confined with one company only because it's yours.
Right. Well, I just want to remind everybody that's listening in, if you have a question, you can enter the question in the Q&A box on the right side of your screen. And I know my colleague, Andres, had a question or two he wanted to ask you, Sharif. So maybe, Andres, if you want to go ahead and fire away, and we'll see if some questions go in the Q&A box.
Hey, Sharif, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you? So I had one quick question about the corporate division and also how your sales and marketing teams are set up. So we know Nestor keeps a pretty lean operation. I think that can definitely be a big advantage for you guys. But how do you ensure that the teams are properly incentivized? How do you ensure that you have enough corporate staff in place to kind of do the things that you want to do? And what are kind of the pros and cons of keeping things lean and mean in your region versus maybe trying to build up some of those functions relative to your peers?
So the idea of being small and agile is unique. We need to keep it this way, and we need to keep the link with the customer as first. So what we try to do from day one is to ensure that our strength is in the countries, not in headquarters. So I have a very strong team in Saudi, a very strong team in Oman, very strong team now in UAE and Kuwait, etc. So what you do when you scale up is you scale up your people in the country. So it's a geo-market structure by the country director, and he has all the segments. And what we do in headquarters is we support the team with people. So if I have today, let's say, a drilling expert, an LWD expert, a wildland expert, that expert today does not sit in Houston, sits in the region. And most of the time, they sit in the largest country. So in a way, they have two hats. They support that country and they support the region. And that gives you that, close to the customer more than close to a headquarter that is 10,000 miles away. You can do that when you're small, and you can do that up to when we become $2, $3 billion revenue. You can. Because if you look at the key for you is to be very close to the customer, the sales team. The other part is from a corporate is you need to have making sure that some of the standardization, some of the message you pass along is very coherent. So today, if I look at my team, I have a VP operation. I have obviously an executive director for Saudi, because Saudi directly reports to me, Oman directly reports to me, and then the rest of the countries report to an EVP operation. I have a person in charge of drilling and evaluation, a person in charge of some of obviously the functions, but no, I would say, no fat, right? It's very lean. And when we want to make sure that the sales organization is stronger, you add salespeople in the country. Because sales mean you need to see the customer. But sales to sit somewhere and have CRM doesn't work. You need to be seeing the customer every day. You need to see what they're doing and very close to them. And I think that philosophy, and that's why you see that our profitability is better. Why? Because the difference, for example, between a country-level profitability to a headquarter-level profitability is like nothing, like 1-2 points, because the headquarter is very, very lean. And we're looking into, definitely this helps us in the downturn, because you know what happens in the downturn. People, unfortunately, release a lot of people. And the beauty we have, we are adding. So we are hiring when other people are releasing. So we have an increase of activity. We are hiring more people. And there is nothing to cut in headquarters because we are extremely lean. Unless you're going to get rid of me and my CFO. So you see, so it's very lean organization in that sense. But meanwhile, you need to make sure we have a proper succession planning to take on position in case of something happens. And by the way, some of our ERT and crisis management, we see as well who is ready to step in every single position if something happens, right? Including my job. So, and that's why we have a senior management team, an executive team, to be able to do that.
Great. Thanks a lot for explaining that, Sharif. James, just out of respect for anyone else on the call that might have questions, I'll hand it back to you to sift through Q&A.
Sure. I think I don't see any questions in the Q&A box, and I know we're bumping up against the hour. Sharif, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I think we'll probably close the webinar there. If you view any closing comments, I'll leave the floor to you.
Thanks, James. Thanks for your kindness. And again, obviously, as you said, apology for the, you guys had some glitches in the morning, but it's definitely very unprecedented time. The downturn, I mean, I personally lived four of them. This one is unique because you have obviously the supply and you have the epidemic across the world. It's something that is very unique. We have a very, very unique position of growing when everybody else is contracting. However, we don't take this for granted, and that's what I want to make sure people understand. We take this in a very, very serious matter, and we have a daily call every day with the full team of the executive management, all of them, and go one by one, client by client, country by country, ensuring the well-being of our people, and ensuring as well we can be the trusted partner to our customer in the current environment and able to cope with the growth. And when they scale down, we are ready as well to scale down. So that agility is a key, and looking forward to for a good year, hopefully, despite what's happening, but definitely our heart and soul with everybody in this current tough environment. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sharif, for this one in the webinar.